At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, everyone, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I am your host, Michael Walker, with my co-host, Mark Bigney. How are you today, Mark?
I'm very well. Have I been demoted? Or have you been promoted?
Did I not say co-host and my co-host?
No, you said host and co-host, like I'm a guest on your show.
That's a mistake. It's the other way around. I'm the special guest.
Well, you're special. I don't know about guest.
You are the host.
You're like the guest that won't leave.
Just for those tax... Remember we were talking about that tax purposes and when they're coming to get me? So I'm just the special guest.
Okay.
So that way when they try to take all of the assets...
This would definitely explain why I'm being audited by the CRA.
Exactly.
So we're going to be talking about board games this week. We're going to talk about the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Aeurus, what we reviewed some period ago. Walker would insist that it was exactly 1 year, but...
I looked at it. It was 12 months ago.
Really?
No.
Okay. You had me for a second. Good job, Walker. Then we're going to talk about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then our topic of the week, which I have entitled Opening the Box Downers. These are things that you see when you open up a game box for the first time and it just brings you down. These are the red flags, the things you see, and they just, you know, kind of put a little bit of a damper on that new box euphoria. So, Walker, what did we review, as you would say, some period of time ago?
We reviewed a game called The Wolves, which was very interesting. You played a pack of wolves, and you went around and you created dens and turned other wolves to your pack, and we have not gone back to it. It is now on BGA. I did play it once on BGA,
okay,
but just to see how the implementation worked, and it was fine, and The Wolves was fine. I remember it being fine, but just really no draw for me.
Yeah, it was indeed fine. It was a perfectly pleasant experience. Frankly, I don't know if this is damning with faint praise or if it's actually just a pejorative. When I think of Pandasaurus Games, they've had a number of games that I very much enjoyed. They were the ones who published Gods Love Dinosaurs. And they also published a game that we're going to be talking about later on this week. So that's what we call a preview, a tease. This is professional podcasting at work.
A window.
Yeah, precisely. And they tend to have like... light middleweight games seems to be part of their core output. And sometimes it's just delightful and everything works. But a lot of the times it's, yeah, this is fine, okay, but nothing that really grabs you in a very strong way. And that's very much how I felt about The Wolves. The biggest thing that I remember about The Wolves, frankly, was how bad the color matching was. We had a great deal of difficulty matching the wolves, which is not a big deal at all.
And I don't want to throw it, like, the mechanically totally different, but just in the essence of how it makes me feel, I throw it in with Hamlet. Remember Hamlet?
Yes.
It was just sort of that same sort of feel. Like, yeah, this works perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And it's fun to play, but I don't wish to go back to it any time.
Yeah. I appreciate the theming. It was slightly more naturalistic.
Yes.
Like, I could very easily have seen this game be themed as some kind of weird generic werewolf thing or weird generic anthropomorphic animal thing, but they just went with wolves. These are just wolves. And I appreciated that, and I liked the visuals, but as you say, it was fine, not particularly memorable, and this is the kind of thing where I only remember it because I was looking it up for the Aeurus. There was no period during the interim where I'm like, whatever happened to the wolves? No, just flit it out of my mind.
That is The Wolves. Now onto the games we played last week. Let's talk about the game most recently on mind, Mark. I've played Tidal Blades 2 Rise of the Enfolders 5 times this week. There are many times I've said I've played solo games and I've gone back to it, but I've literally woken up and gone right into Tidal Blades 2 multiple times. I'm very much enjoying it. It's very different than the usual dungeon crawlers, you know, where you have your blacks and grays and it's dull and you're in the dungeon. It's the grindy. This is bright, beautiful, you know, blues, water, you know, pink and crazy animals. attacking you, and the flow is great. You have this grid where you're playing cards to do your actions. It has this Gloomhaven feel to it, where the monsters, you know, have their own cards with, you know, that show what they're going to do and their own hit points, and easy to track, great bases. I think the flow was just great. Many things to like about Tidal Blades 2.
It's all right. I mean, so the action selection mechanism, you did a good job of trying to situate it as some kind of thematic element, right? But ultimately, it strikes me as just a gamey, puzzly concession, which, frankly, is okay, because I get some of the same vibes from Gloomhaven, right? The card selection and card management of Gloomhaven is not particularly evocative of any notion that I might have about fantasy adventuring, but nonetheless, it provides a very compelling strategic and tactical puzzle to try to maximize your actions. In the context of Tidal Blades, Rise of the Enfolders, that has got to be among the worst subtitles of all. And look, I play video games and I play board games. I've seen a lot of terrible subtitles,
Mark,
over the course of my life. Yes?
The Enfolders.
They're rising?
They're rising.
Yeah.
And we must tell the people this. You see,
couldn't it be the development of the happening?
No.
Couldn't it be the eventuality of the thing? Couldn't it have been the circumstance of the positioning? Like, all of these would have been better subtitles.
The leveling of the mediocre.
There you go. So the way that it works is you've got a 3x3 grid, and on your board you have basic buffs, like buff an attack, or do a little bit of a move, or do a little bit of defense, or get a little bit of the resource you use to buff other things. And you play a card on top of the grid, and you run either the entire line or the entire column. Now, at the start of the game, this is mostly just going to be the printed bonuses on the boards. But as you're playing more cards, it allows you to trigger the same card over and over, minimum of 3 times, if it's the first card you play over the course of the grid. You know, you play to the corner, then you play next to it, then you play next to that, and you get to run that card 3 times. But frankly, this ends up feeling very generic, partially by virtue of how generic the actions are. You know, the actions themselves are move, attack, situational corner buffs.
It's true, but if you've, you know, reflect back to dungeon crawling, that's all you're doing is,
yes.
And normally it's just called the attack. It's not, you don't get to work anything out. It's like, I'm going to attack, and this is my bog standard attack every time I attack.
100%. And here's the thing. I'm perfectly willing to play bog standard dungeon crawls. And what I'm suggesting is that Rise of the Enfolders has not done very much to differentiate it from bog standard dungeon crawls. I agree with you entirely about the color palette. The universe, they care so much about this universe. And it appears that they're not alone, the designers and developers. You love this universe.
I do.
I think visually it does a great job of differentiating itself from other dungeon crawls. I feel that, therefore, the palette and the aesthetic is working much, much better for me by virtue of its uniqueness when compared to the other games of the various series. At that point, it was just, you know, various cartoony. I could do without the spoken narration. There's this vibe that I get of people doing accents. You know, here's some person doing their Jamaican accent. Here's some person doing their...
I did look into it. It is a company, and there's no sort of... It is those actual people. There's no sort of... They've brought people in from that background. There's no sort of
over-gimmicky
things. Yeah.
That is great. I very much appreciate that. It's just a very strong Saturday morning cartoon vibe.
It is, for sure.
Like, no, and that's what they're going for. That's clearly what they're going for, and it's well executed. It is not something that I find particularly appealing, frankly. And I don't know how the campaign's going to develop. I don't know how the character abilities are going to develop, because everything's got to have a campaign. They're a squishy fruit again. Got to love the squishy fruit. I, by the way, have an audio file of Walker saying squishy fruit 7 times in succession, and I play it on occasion to remind me of the professional and tremendous human being.
Yes, that's why,
Walker
that's why you play it.
Yeah, precisely. But frankly, it I don't know why you're raving with the flow. The flow's fine, but it's not particularly brisk. And given that there are many outstanding campaigns begging for our attention.
There is. All I'm getting at is that the line of sight rules are nice and simple. The
yes.
Monster, AI, same thing, nice and easy to manipulate.
True.
You know, it bogs down a bit. You know, you're constantly moving this initiative track up and down, but that adds a little bit of, you know, pre-thinking, and that, you know, I'm going to play a card that, you know, bumps me up in initiative because I want to go first.
Yep.
So there are some things there that I'm just enjoying.
So Fateforge, Oathsworn, Gloomhaven, these are big, big heavy hitters.
They are.
And I think that unless you're really into the universe, I don't know that this has a whole... Because it's not family weight. If this were a family weight game, I think things might be...
It's getting there, though.
I
feel it being lighter than the rest. And it does walk you through
I don't think
it.
It's lighter than Fateforge. I think it's roughly at the same level of mechanical complexity as Fateforge. I don't think that I would feel comfortable playing Rise of the Enfolders with children. I think that they would be overwhelmed with the permutations.
Maybe.
I'm perfectly willing to play it. It's fine. I wasn't disappointed. I came in with low expectations because of my general disinterest towards the previous Tidal Blades offerings. And so I've been hearing you rave about it for a few days. So it's not like I got my expectations raised by that. I'm just like, oh, well, Walker really likes Tidal Blades. It's great that there's more Tidal Blades that appeals to Tidal Blades fans. If you're one of those Tidal Blades fans, Rise of the Enfolders may be that dungeon crawl that you've been waiting for. As it is, I would prefer to get back to some of the outstanding campaigns that we haven't gone back to in a few weeks.
Agreed. I didn't actually play the official solo rules. I just two-handed.
Sure.
And I didn't even look just because of that reason. It's like, oh, there's this whole system to run another character. And
yeah.
I'm just like, it's not that complicated.
Yeah.
I'm just going to two-hand it. And anyway.
And in terms of having a hand of cards, we're talking about only four cards.
Exactly.
It's not particularly difficult. Yeah.
So that is Tidal Blades 2, Rise of the Enfolders, designed by Tim Elsner and Ben Elsner and put out by Druid City Games.
Another co-op crawly combat thing is the Mass Effect board game Priority Hagalaz. Again, I'm pretty sure that's how it's pronounced. This is designed by Eric Lang and Calvin Wong-Seiloon, published by Modiphius Entertainment. And we went back to it with Louis and Huey. This is the second scenario we did. One of the things that the Mass Effect board game does, which is very evocative of the Mass Effect video games as well as every other BioWare game, is you can do loyalty missions that are keyed to specific characters. And in the context of the board game, not only are they thematically linked to the background of the characters, but it also allows them to unlock a particular skill, attribute, or ability that is linked to their loyalty mission. So given that the structure of the campaign is very, very fixed, you will have the option of doing up to two loyalty missions between various acts. They are optional. And so we decided to do a loyalty mission for a character that needed to be buffed a little bit. And unfortunately, what this did was it leaned into the fact that in Mass Effect, the victory conditions are not particularly interesting. They tend to be the least interesting thing to do over the course of the game. It's get someone to a terminal and have them hit a button over and over. And in this context, at least, there were two terminals, and we had to get the same character from Terminal 1 to Terminal 2, but that was the character whose loyalty mission it was. And so all that she was doing was walking to a terminal, hitting a button, and then going to the next terminal. It was her chance to be the star. Couldn't you have her do something interesting? Meanwhile, other characters are killing enemies, and my character, who's Shepard, who is the supreme commander badass in the series, his job was that of door opener, because the only other person who could open doors was the person who could activate the terminal.
Hit the buttons.
Yeah, and between her hitting buttons and opening doors so she can hit the button, it's better than hit the button.
It all depends on how good she is at telling stories, because at the end of the day, she could really, burn that yarn and how exciting it was to go through and dangerous and, intricately hitting buttons.
Yeah, so we were the ones in charge of making sure that the figures actually moved around and stuff, and so I don't think that she, being an inanimate object, would be in a position to fool us as to what was actually going on. Yeah, but otherwise it's compelling. So one of the chief complaints that we had all had about the first scenario was that it was very, very narrow, very limited, and every time we killed something, a new enemy would spawn right back in front of our face, and so it just felt like a bit of a static slog. This map was far more open, despite the fact that it had locked doors to unlock. It was just, rather than a series of winding corridors, it was pretty much an open hex map with some walls in it. And so that was very pleasant, and we had more room to maneuver, more room to consider about where we wanted to be. And this time we came forearmed with the knowledge of the aggressive rates of spawn, and so we would spawn camp. We would sit on the spawn areas just so that every time an AI card said spawn an enemy at the closest available spawn point, it would be further away than right in front of our face. On top of that, we swapped out Garrus, who is extraordinarily disappointingly weak, for Rex, who is predictably deadly at short range. He's a giant Krogan with a shotgun, so you don't mess with him. And all told, it was much, much more successful and fluid. At the same time, though, this is emphasizing two things that are increasingly clear about the Mass Effect board game. Number one, it is too easy. Even when it was a static slog, it's not that it was particularly challenging. It's that we felt constrained. And so it wasn't didn't feel like we were engaging in interesting positioning or particularly fun moves. In a more open map, And strangely enough, fighting the Reapers rather than Cerberus, they just seemed vastly more easy. We never felt challenged at all. And the other big problem, which kind of dovetails with my complaints about the scenario objectives, I think Mass Effect the board game is a two-player game masquerading as a multiplayer game. There's just not really a whole heck of a lot to do for any given character, even when they're not burdened with a very narrow and unengaging set of victory conditions for the scenario. So we're playing it with three, which is the worst possible combination anyway, because one person has two characters and the two other people have one. That always, it just bothers me in a way that I'm hard-pressed to identify, but that asymmetry is not something that I appreciate. Playing four players would be slightly better, but again, there's not a whole lot to do for an individual character, especially if they have, you know, wasted actions abound. There are circumstances where it's like, well, I could move and put myself at risk and not spawn camp on this spawn point, but I think I'll just stop after having done two actions, which when that's the most effective turn you can do very often, that's somewhat disappointing. So all told, there's stuff to like about Mass Effect the board game. Thematically, there's some stuff there, and if you're a fan of the property, there's a lot of touchstones, and the fact that the structure of loyalty missions is so evocative of the video game is really neat. And I enjoy spending time in this universe, and I love the characters, but all told, it is somewhat too easy, and there's somewhat not enough to do on your individual turns. And so consequently, I don't know how much more of this campaign we're going to go. It really depends on how much Louis is feeling it. Louis is the one who has not had much experience with the Mass Effect property before, so we'll see how he feels about it going forward. But suffice to say, not entirely unlike my situation with Rise of the Unfolders. If people want to play it, I'll join along for the ride. I don't find it obnoxious, but I don't find it quite as good as it ought to be. And given the property and given the design pedigree, I confess I am rather disappointed. So that is Mass Effect the board game, Priority Hagalaz.
So you said Kruger had a shotgun, did you?
The Krogan had a
shotgun. Krogan had a shotgun. But was it a sniper shotgun? You see, in the game, the loop that we played, I had a sniper shotgun mark.
Yes.
And sniper shotguns are the biz-bombity.
You'd think they wouldn't be that effective, and yet.
And yet. So Loop is put out by Catch Up Games and Pandasaurus Games and designed by Maxine Ramborg and Theo Rivera. And I was very put off by this game when it first came out. This has been out for a while. It's always had a ton of buzz. And it's just something about the cover and the art design. I just dismissed it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was something totally different. I knew it was some sort of time traveling thing, but I had no interest in it whatsoever. And I'm so glad that you got it and I was able to play it because it is a ton of fun. It's a cooperative game, sort of pandemic. You're rushing around, putting out fires. You're pushing clones around and destroying them by getting them back in their own environment.
The evil Dr. Foe is trying to take over the world by seeding various past eras of the world with his clones. And the way you eliminate clones is you have to shove them into an era that is identified as being their paradoxical era, and then they get destroyed. So yes, that you don't actually fight them, you just move them around until they're at the place where they die.
Yeah, it doesn't really, it does not have a feel of time travel whatsoever, in my opinion.
I
at no time.
Yeah.
See, no time. I at no time.
I only just got it right now.
Yeah, did you?
That was brilliant.
Oh. Has it even sort of like a little dexterity component, not mechanical component, but
no,
you get to
it's
drop,
got a little toy.
That's it's got a little toy. You get to drop these cubes in the tower, and they shoot out the little sides.
Yeah, there's a little tower that basically randomizes where the danger cubes are going to go into one of three possible areas, and the card tells you where to point the middle of the toy, and then how many cubes.
A little
to
bit
drop
like
in.
Dark Tower, the skull
yeah.
shooting out. Yeah,
yeah,
much like
but
that.
But much more efficient, both in terms of the fact that it is not app driven and it does not require $100 plastic toy in the middle.
That's right. It's got this disco vibe to it, with the way the characters are portrayed and you know, psychedelic colors. And
yeah, the color palette is very disco, and the cartoon style is very striking. I agree with you that the cover is perhaps the least appealing part of the overall graphic package.
For sure.
Because the characters are delightful.
Yes.
The artifacts are delightful. The overall vibe of the board is great. Tonally, I think the Loop is pitch perfect. It's really, really funny and cute and unique looking. I agree with you entirely that it doesn't really feel like time travel. I have yet to play a game that feels a whole heck of a lot like time travel. We talk about this when we talk about Anachrony. It just has a loan system
yeah.
Dressed up as time travel. Here, instead of, you know, it's not especially Pandemic derivative, but, you know, the shadow of Pandemic looms large over every co-op game. But instead of moving from Chicago to Atlanta, you're moving from the medieval age to the Renaissance age. Yeah, so there's the trappings, but it doesn't feel like time travel. There's no...
No, and even the graphic design on the board doesn't really portray it as different time zones really either.
Yeah, it's mostly just icons, frankly.
Different colors and different icons.
I was rather surprised they didn't print the name of the era on the board. I think that might have helped a little bit.
Agreed.
But as it is, yeah, so you have a hand of three cards, and these are artifacts. You can get lots more artifacts. This is one of those games where it's not quite, it's kind of deck building, but not really. Mostly it's that you start with some pretty interesting toys, and you're getting new toys all the time. And not only do they let you do interesting things in terms of moving cubes around or adding energy or moving other agents around your fellow players or doing things through your fellow players or moving clones of Dr. Foe around and all these wonderful things, but they're also just cute, like the aforementioned sniper shotgun, and all rendered in this very compelling style. I think the loop gets a lot right. On top of that, the game itself is very enjoyable.
Yeah, it's got this neat mechanic. Like Merc said, you have the artifacts. You can use them all once. And it has this interesting ability where you can use some energy and recharge them all.
The eponymous loop.
Yeah, all of them must have the same symbol. So all the artifacts have this variety of symbols. So if you build your deck in a certain way, by grabbing, you know, all the symbols of one type, you have a better chance of using all of these items multiple times in a turn. It's kind of neat.
Yeah, more efficient turns as a consequence. We barely won. It went down to the wire, and this is the earliest difficulty level. There's a whole bunch of different scenarios. You can grapple with super clones. There are a couple of expansion modules available. One of them sees you fighting a giant kaiju. They're somewhat difficult to track down. I'm not really in a position to get access to them. But, I mean, there's tons of content in the base box as it is, and I'm kind of looking forward to trying some of the other scenarios in the loop. Once again, that's Maxime Cambourg and Théo Rivière, Pandasaurus Games. Got to play Cryo. I've been meaning to play Cryo for a while because Cryo is my favorite game by Luke Laurie. He co-designed it with Tom Jolly, and after having played Andromeda's Edge not too long ago, I've been hankering to get back to Cryo. Because the best element that Luke Laurie ever designed, I think, is something that he first introduced in the context of Dwellings of Eldervale. This is in terms of publication history. My understanding is that Cryo was designed prior to the publication of Dwellings of Eldervale, but I take no judgment on such things, whereby you get to build your own engine. You get these tokens that get to be slotted in to various programmatics, and so you pick up a token that says this is one ore. Well, you can cash it in for an ore, or you can... No pun intended. You can slot it into a card that has a blank that says pay one blank for some good benefit. It's like, oh, I'll put the ore in, and now what that card means is pay one ore for some benefit. And Cryo does this, and it's really well done.
It all works the same sort of way in all three of those games.
Yes.
And it sort of takes that one sort of phase of games that is boring and makes it exciting, because it's always the reset phase that you get to engage with this engine. It's when you bring stuff back, and then you start triggering all this engine that you've built.
Yes. Unfortunately, in the context of Andromeda's Edge, those would be your longest turns by far.
Oof.
And someone would be a minute into their resource manipulation and invariably would say, no, I'm not going to be affecting the map. Just go ahead, take your turn. And in Cryo, on the other hand, just remains consistently fast moving the entire time. It is much, much simpler than either Dwellings of Eldervale or Andromeda's Edge. And I think that is to its advantage. It's got a much better tempo. And indeed, the tempo manipulation is where you get some of the real teeth, because the theme of the game is that you crash landed on a planet where you're all going to freeze to death unless you get into the cave system. And you have to be waking up pods of sleeping colonists. And whenever you pass, whenever you take all your workers back, in addition to being able to activate your engine, you trigger what's called a crisis token. And this might be sabotage, which involves blowing up some colonists.
Well, that would never happen, Mark. That seems evil and inhumane.
That would be the act of a monster. Only a true monster would do that. Or the act of someone who's pulling back all their workers when there are four sabotage tokens on the board and they must thus activate one of them. Anyway... Cryo is as good as I remember. I definitely think that this is the ideal iteration of the formula. If you find Andromeda's Edge or Dwellings of Eldervale a little overbaked, which quite frankly I think you should, then Cryo is a wonderful antidote. I think it is very approachable in terms of rules load. It is definitely medium light as far as worker placements go. And I also just really like the visual design. I think it's a very effectively done Euro, and I think it is mechanically cute. And doesn't overstay its welcome.
Multi-use cards, like massively multi-use cards.
Yeah, burn them for resources, use them for special powers, use them for endgame victory points, use them for a vehicle. Because one of the key ways you get points is the area majority scoring at the end of the game. Mostly, again, when a Euro is, especially when it's medium light, I like the scoring to be reasonably focused. And the overwhelming majority of your scoring is going to be coming from how many colonists you're able to get into the underground cave system, which works thematically and helps focus your energies. And ultimately, the conclusion of our game saw a tie that was not broken by the tiebreaker, and so you get to rejoice in shared victory.
It was
a very tight match. Much rejoicing was had. Well, except for the couple losers, but who cares about them?
Yeah.
They
died in their pods. No one cares.
Cryo by Tom Jolly and Luke Laurie, published by Z-Man Games in 2021.
So I introduced five new people to the greatest card game of all time. And it was enjoyed by all. And it's, like I said, I've got the teach down pat.
For those of us that are uninitiated, Walker, you could share. Those of you who don't know what the greatest card game of all time
is. For those who have never played board games before and are completely out of the loop, it is a game called Flip 7. And the teach is dead easy. You just tell them, you know, you're either going to hit or pass when it's your turn, and then I'm going to go to the next player. If you hit and it's the same base number as that you already have, you've busted and you're out. If it is the seventh card in your line and you haven't busted, then the round is over and you score an additional 15 points. Or you pass and you get to score those cards that you already have. And then you just cover the special cards as they come out because they're random anyway. And you're off to the races in like 3 minutes of teaching. It's fantastic. Card game. Can't wait to bring it to family functions. Flip 7.
Just as a note, the hyperbole of saying it is the greatest card game ever is merely echoing the marketing copy that is on the side of the box, and is not a sincere evaluation on the part of Michael Walker as to the merits of Flip 7. He likes it, just not that much. Question, Walker, have you ever seen someone get to 7 cards and score the 15-point bonus?
No.
Okay. It has always just been the siren temptation that causes someone to bust.
I tried to pressure him, and the card that did come up would have put him to 7, but he chickened out. And
just pocketed a large number of points anyway.
Yeah, maybe. Because he also had the times two, so you could see why he would want to pass in that particular situation.
Ooh, yeah, okay, that was the right call, yeah. Well, that's one of the great things about Push Your Luck games, the peer pressure. You got to have peer pressure in Push Your Luck games.
Yeah. And you got to have the banter. So this is Flip 7, designed by Eric Olson and put out by OP Games.
Walker showed me Rebel Princess. This is by Daniel Byrne, Jose Gerardo Guerrero, Kevin Palaeth, Tirso Virgos, and published by Zombie Paella, which I have to say I would never order if it were on a menu. And this is a trick-taking game. I have yet to play by the recommended length of game. The recommended length of game is 5 rounds. I've commented on this before. Trick-taking games are often at an awkward position because you want to be able to balance out the luck of the draw, because a given card draw can very, very heavily influence who's going to do well in a given round. But by the same token, if you're just doing the same thing over and over again, it can overstay its welcome. And nobody necessarily outside of hardcore bridge circles wants to spend, you know, 2+ hours playing the same trick-taking game. There may be exceptions, but that's certainly been my experience. And so I completely respect the fact that, Walker, I've played a 3-round game, I've played a 4-round game. 4-round game may be a reasonably good balance, I don't know, but I'd try a 5-round game as well. In part because I actually quite like the different round modifications. Every round there's a significant modifier to how the game works. The one that I didn't like was at the start of the hand, designate which cards you're going to play as your first 4 and which cards you're going to designate as your last 4. And so there are just calculations about void go completely out the window because nobody's void in almost everyone's void in almost everything. And so it becomes a little too chaotic for my taste.
Yeah, I had some crazy ones. I played it twice this week, and ones we had in our game was one where you put down one card at the very start of the round, and that would be the card that you play in the last hand.
I liked that one. That was really cool.
The one that was crazy confusing was called the even odd. So if an odd card was played, then you had to follow with an odd card. If you didn't happen to have an odd card that suit, then you could play an even. But if you had an odd, you had to play it, or an even if you had to play it. Yeah. That was crazy, and it was unfortunate because it was like right after Flip 7, so it was once again 5 new players that had never played it, and it was the very first modifier.
Oh my!
Right, so it just threw a game
that's a huge
a
jump
new game into crazy confusion, but they got there.
Yeah, we had to look up how some powers interacted with each other because the text on the card itself was a little lacking in terms of clarity. But the rulebook was able to disambiguate all these questions. So ultimately, that's only a mild criticism. Rebel Princess is very much the same tradition as Spades, except there's no bidding. It is a game where points are bad and you want to avoid getting certain cards, but there's also an off suit card that gives you 5 points, and you have to be very careful about when that's going to hit. I appreciate that kind of tension. I like looking at a hand and saying, ooh, I have the card that could win the frog. I don't like that. I have to figure out how I'm going to deal with that. And on top of that, you start leveraging your special powers to manipulate that. For example, given that modifier that we very much like, at the start of the hand, pre-designate what your last card is going to be. I pre-designated one of my cards that was going to win the frog if the frog came out. The frog is the green 8, and I had the green 10. So I pre-designated the green 10, figuring one of two things was going to happen. Either the frog was going to hit the table before the last trick, or it wasn't. If it was going to hit the table before the last card, I didn't have to worry about the green 10 being forced to play it and having to win it. And if it didn't, and if it was going to come out the last, I had my character special power. My character special power was, for one trick only, you can reverse the number priority. So 10 is the lowest, not the highest, and 1 is the highest, not the lowest. So sure enough, the frog hadn't hit the table. I was able to trigger the power and just know that I didn't have to worry about the frog. I appreciate that. So that is Rebel Princess. Still a fair amount of luck of the draw, but whatever. It's a light tricking game with a delightful theme about dying childless and alone. And which, you know what, I can get behind. And so I definitely think that in the welcome glut. Glut sounds negative. In the profusion.
I think this is going to be the year of trick-taking games. It seems to so far.
Yes. The number of novel trick-taking games, some of them really break the mold. Rebel Princess, I don't think really does. It's certainly not anywhere in the same league as things like Ghosts of Christmas or Pala, where you're really messing with the fundamental structure of trick-taking. It's just a bunch of usually mild, although sometimes a little bit counterintuitive modifiers on a very well-worn trick-taking formula. This is not a criticism, just trying to situate it in the large number of alternative takes to trick-taking that we've been experiencing over the past couple years, and I, for one, welcome it.
I understand our listeners are very loyal, Mark, so I'm sure they will not rot us out. So I'm going to tell them that Mark and I participated in a heist this week.
And there worry, it wasn't a big heist.
No, it was tiny.
It was a tiny heist.
It was tiny little lasers. Tiny little laser heist. This is published by Evan and Josh. It's a very special game company, don't you know?
Yes, Evan Katz and Josh Roberts have Evan and Josh's very special games company.
And they don't even credit a designer. They don't.
It's designed by Evan Katz and Josh Roberts.
I know. Yeah. But I mean, they don't credit the designer. They don't credit any artist. It is a very much a toy dexterity game. You're putting these elastics through this square cube grid that you've constructed, and then they've designed these fantastic sort of like little lock boxes that stack just enough for them to stay upright.
And so they stack pretty poorly, but that was by design.
So they stack together in different colors, and then the whole sort of stack of locks go on top of a diamond, which goes on top of a cushion. Stick with me here. So whoever's turn it is, they say, we're going to go for this particular diamond, and now you have to move those lock boxes off of the diamond onto another stack of lock boxes, and then you have to move the diamond off the cushion into the center pedestal.
Sounds easy, Walker.
Sounds totally easy. All the while deking out all of these elastics that are back and forth through all the thing.
Still sounds too easy, Walker.
Well, Mark, you don't get to use your hands, you see. You get to use this long pole with these rubber hands attached to them.
Tiny hands, even?
And you get to work with a partner. You're both trying to manipulate this long pole hand while picking up these little tiny plastic lock boxes and then moving across the whole map while dodging these elastics and stacking them dexterously on top of other things. Fantastic game. Will play anytime.
So this is a Kickstarter that recently fulfilled, and I was pledging mostly on the audacity of the design, because something like this has to be engineered borderline perfectly. If the elastics aren't right, if the frame isn't right, if something is warped, if the hands don't work properly, there's any number of points of failure in terms of the components. For what it is worth, in terms of full disclosure, I have seen reports of people whose copies don't really work very properly. Usually, the common complaint that I've seen in more than one instance is that the lasers will not remain attached to the superstructure of the cube. In my experience, in my copy, if anything, the lasers are pretty robust, because when you're engaged in a heist, not only is it the case that you have to worry about the fact that you're manipulating these tiny hands in a very awkward way, but you have a time limit. And the time limit is the one that killed us. Only one heist failed because of a laser. Warm Boy ran straight headfirst at that laser, and snapped like crazy.
It caught on one of the hands on the end of the sticks. They're not molded together.
Yeah, they have individualized fingers and a thumb that's sticking up.
So his thumb hooked onto one of the lasers, unbeknownst to him.
Most of the time, though, most heists failed, and almost all the heists failed by virtue of the time limit. Because trying to move the initial stack would usually prompt some kind of cascade of failures. Like, you'd knock over another stack, and so now not only did you have to worry about the initial stack that you're manipulating, you have to restack this other stack, and you're trying to fix the second stack, and then you knock over the third stack, and okay, fine.
Yeah, and then they have another mechanic on top of that where if you stack onto one stack, then you can't stack on that stack again.
Yep.
You got to go to different stacks.
So many different stacks. I am, frankly, inclined to consider some house rules. One common house rule, again, that I've seen used a couple of times is that rather than 90 seconds as the default, you can use 120 seconds as the default. Huey's not certain that would do the job. He seemed to be under the impression, especially given the cascade of failures situation that I talked about, that the extra 30 seconds was not going to help in many instances. I don't know. It's just, I appreciate the fact that there's a high failure rate of the heists. I think it just might be a little bit too high because the scoring thus becomes very swingy, because when you succeed in a heist, you have to prearrange how many money cards everyone's going to get, but the money cards range in value from 0 to 4 million. And so if you've got a 0, a 1, and a 2, and you get beaten by somebody who only has a single money card of 4, that's not hot.
Yeah, I really felt that that's where the game felt very flat. I'm not understanding why they did not make it a cooperative game.
Sure.
And so you're playing against the game, and I think that would really have made it much more fun.
A cooperative variant, I think, would be very welcome. It would also make the player count a little bit easier, because this is nominally a 3-6 player game where you need at least two people on a heist. It says in the rule book, look, if you think you can do it by yourself with one hand, by all means, go for it. But that was mostly a joke. You can't do it with one hand. If you can, that'd be impressive. But anyway, and I talked about this mostly in the context of For Science, which is a real-time cooperative dexterity game, which are three things that tend to cause some people to just nope out of the possibility of an experience. And here we have a real-time toy-based dexterity game, which, again, not necessarily going to be for everybody, and you have to get at least 4, 5, or 6 people together. And that's a bit of a lift, at least in our case. And so I would very much appreciate a co-op version. I would very much appreciate a variant where the heists became a little bit easier, because on top of this, there are these mischief cards that other people who are not involved in the heist can play. Some of these mischief cards make the heist more difficult and give you money when and if the heist fails. Well, the average heist is apt to fail anyway, a non-trivial amount of the money entering the system is going to be from the mischief cards. Make no mistake, I like it when dexterity games encourage you to develop a little bit of skill. Like, Ice Cool does this very well, and Ice Wizards as well. You start to be able to get to do curve shots, and it doesn't take a whole heck of a lot of practice. I just think the Tiny Laser Heist is a little bit too daunting right from the start. Nonetheless, all those complaints out of the way, I agree with you, it's a blast. I would very much suggest it to anybody that likes dexterity games of that ilk. It does exactly what it sets out to do, and I think in a very charming package. I just think it's a little too daunting, and the mischief cards are a little miscalibrated. So I would welcome any variants or variations that would allow to get to a slightly better balance of successful heists. And for what it's worth, for those of you with copies that don't quite work as intended, you have my sympathy. So that is Tiny Laser Heist by Evan Katz and Josh Roberts. Evan and Josh's very special games. Walker finally got his copy of DEI in, DVD et Impera. And frankly, I find it difficult to look at the box and not think of just too many off-color jokes about DEI, given the way it's been discussed recently in the past few years. But anyway, this is by Ludus Magnus Studio. Big Ludus! They of Black Rose Wars and a number of other games. And this was designed by Tommaso Battista, who is best known as being the co-designer of Barrage. But this is a solo design by him. And this is an area majority game with a variety of interesting scoring elements. Walker did a very, very good job of making a very appropriate analogy when he first explained the game.
It was just, because there's a lot of problems when Scythe first came out, where you saw the giant stompy mechs in a map, and people who never played Scythe before would immediately think, oh, great, we're going to play a fighty game. And DEI almost doubles down, in my opinion, on this, because we have troops on a map and these giant drones around and leaders and area majority. And it looks, okay, this is going to be a hoedown. And it is it is totally holeless.
Have you ever been to a hoedown, Walker?
I have not.
I don't think there is violence. Who told you what a hoedown is? I think you might be confused with a hootenanny.
Oh,
my understanding is that in your average hootenanny, somewhere between 33% to 66% of the participants will die.
Gotcha.
But a hoedown is a peaceful affair.
Ah, I see where I made the mistake. Anyway, played this on Board Game Arena a while ago. Did not enjoy it. Was kind of scared for this crowdfunding to complete. But when I was reading the rule book, I had very high hopes, and so explained it out, and I was very happy that everyone enjoyed it. It's very much not a fighty game. There are ways to remove troops, mostly with the drones and some of the cards sometimes, because you are a little bit of deck building as well, which is kind of interesting.
Rather a lot.
And so you're moving around trying to get area majority in different areas for different reasons. There are these guilds of varying colors. And I love the fact that you don't need to hold them for the whole game. You just have to hold them for a certain amount of time that you show on your board that you've got it, and then you don't have to worry about it. You move on to something else.
It encourages a certain amount of dynamism because it could very easily, there's a low unit count, and moving around is occasionally a little difficult, not terribly burdensome, but a little difficult. And if the victory conditions had been miscalibrated, I think things could have become very stodgy. But fortunately, there are two things that heavily mitigate what could have been a very static affair. One of them is, as you say, the victory conditions tend to be very ad hoc. You have to hold certain kinds of territory at various times, but once that's done, you're on to the next thing. You don't have enough units on the board to start covering all the bases or to heavily start denying the points to somebody else. You've got bigger fish to fry. You've got to go get your own victory conditions. At the top of the game, there are 8 victory conditions that get dealt out, 2 per round. And you can always satisfy any column that you haven't already satisfied before. So you're only foreclosing one other victory condition if you score one of them. So you look at the board and you figure, okay, well, these ones don't look like early game objectives to me. So I'm going to kind of build towards those later. These ones I think I might be able to grab in turn one, so let me make a push for that and see what I can do. And you maximize your score on that axis, and then you're done with that. Move along.
Yeah, it's an interesting mechanic because they are based on sort of turn order, right? It's like victory conditions for 1, 2, 3, and 4. But like you said, you get to do them whenever you want. But if you do one from a previous round, you have to score less points. And it's an interesting race because there's a race to get these, unique resources at the beginning because, they're usually hard to get. They're just the ones that are on the board populated at the beginning and looking at the victory conditions and which ones you should get right away.
And that leads to the second thing, which is resource depletion. And the resources are pretty much only used to buy new cards. But the new cards are great. First of all, they're a non-trivial source of points. They're just worth a whack of points at the end of the game. And they're just much, much better than the cards you start with. So you might have a starting card that gives you a couple of movement actions, but you might get an upgraded card that gives you 3 movement actions that allow you to ignore elevation and suddenly you're jumping all over the place.
Yeah, there's not only more actions, but there's this whole sort of upgraded action system where the actions are different colors, and based on the color, they do a different thing. Lots to like about. And what do you think about the drones being able to be controlled by anyone? When you pick a faction, it sort of comes with a drone, and you get a card for that drone in your starting hand. But eventually, you seed the market with the rest of the cards, so they could come up and anyone could buy them. So people could start taking care of your drone, and they introduce it like people are hacking it. And
I thought it introduced yet another welcome level of flexibility to what could have otherwise been a stodgy game. Because movement is difficult, deployment is difficult, it's hard to spread your influence around. But if you want to devote yourself to acquiring the resources to buying more drone cards, well, that's a way to project your presence and influence over areas of the map that you might have difficulty accessing otherwise.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because in the game, the particular game we played, one of the victory conditions was to have drone cards. And the fact that you can hack it like that, I think really sort of allows you to have very interesting drone powers. But when given to only one faction, might sway the game in a unfun way.
Sure.
When you open that up for anyone to get to use that drone, then it sort of equals it out and doesn't make it so daunting.
Absolutely. I was very pleasantly surprised by Divideat in Pera. As I say, I only really know Tommaso Battista from his co-design work with Simone Luciani in Barrage. And Ludus Magnus Studio has done a number of things that are of dubious quality. But, you know, Black Rose Wars is good for a laugh. And so the fact that they made a interesting set of victory conditions and an interesting kind of card flow for an area majority game, effectively a very, very solid offering.
And so there's a billion expansions. This is the second crowdfunding that we got. And so we got the newest expansion. The factions that come in it are twice as complicated as the ones that come in the base box. So we left them out for the first game. We'll look at those.
Yeah, there's a version where you get to play as a bear. And Walker looked at this and said, no bear. Nobody gets bear.
They come with their own rule books. And they break, you know, the basic rules.
Just giving you a hard time.
I know. And I just wanted to get, you know.
Oh, you think bear's going to play by the rules?
No.
Bear plays by their own rules.
Bear does what bear wants. I understand this. And so that's DEI. And last for me, we got to play Modern Art. This is a great Reiner Knizia game. We played the edition that was the CMON edition.
With a delightful little wooden gavel.
Little gavel. And the art is hilarious. And
I was very pleased by how much people leaned in to selling the painting that they were offering for sale. Dewey, in particular, was giving this entire life story about how, well, you know, this is the artist's grandfather who was very influential to him. This was after the death of a family pet. I was stunned. Even Louis was getting into it, talking about the various, you know, this was the period of the artist when he was known for making a series of works. It was great.
I can see in different groups where it might break down into sort of a points edition, figuring out, you know, what everything's worth and, you know, plus minus type game. But I think we left it pretty well open after I was calmed down a bit. And and I very much enjoyed Modern Art. I know I played it years ago and enjoyed getting back to it.
Some people find it frustrating because the economy is not really what you're playing with in Modern Art. You're playing the table. It's one of those games where it's very, not psychological, although there's a little bit of that. You can kind of read the table and see if people are bidding really hot, then that might encourage you to try to offload a painting and sell it for more than you think it's going to be worth. But it's more about reacting to other people's holdings, trying to make inferences on other people's hands. For example, there were a couple of blue paintings that get offered up. And the value of a painting at the end of the round is a function of how many paintings get offered. So when the first couple of paintings get offered, you have no idea how much they're going to be worth at the end of the round. Doesn't matter whether it's round one or round four. And Walker was clockwise from the person offering these two paintings. And he made a very aggressive bid. You can infer from that that Walker has some blue in his hand. And he figures he's going to be able to offload those, both pocketing some money as a consequence, because once there are three or four paintings out on the table, they're worth much, much more, and further control of the tempo of the round. The problem is, this is useful information. It doesn't help me, though, because if I overbid that aggressive bid and win the blue paintings, Walker's not going to play ball to help me. He'll play ball to help him. And so the relative value of these different paintings really shifts based on things like turn order and the nature of the round. And those are the kinds of calculations that I think Reiner Knizia does extraordinarily well in a lot of his auction games. And I think Modern Art is arguably the best at doing those kinds of calculations.
I'd like to play it more because I am a little bit worried about how severe turn order does matter.
It can matter a lot. My biggest concern or criticism of Modern Art is that the double cards are very, very powerful. Because when you can offer up two paintings for sale on your turn rather than one, well, that's kind of like taking two turns one after the other. And that's very good. The other issue that sometimes arises is that it's sometimes a problem, but generally not. This is more of a theoretical concern than one that manifests regularly, is that it is possible for someone to throw the game. If someone radically miscalculates or is too aggressive in an irrational way, they can just start shoveling money to people in a semi-arbitrary way. This I've only ever seen happen once In practice, it tends to control itself, but it's always a theoretical concern that I have.
And that is Reiner Knizia's Modern Art.
Now a brief break while we pay some bills.
Gear Patrol just called their ISO-certified dive watch the best sub-$500 dive watch. Full stop. And their ceramic watch material almost magical. The Wall Street Journal called them iconoclastic cool, potentially redefining the industry itself. Who are we talking about? It's Movement. And they're leveling up your gift giving with the biggest deals of the holiday season and the sleekest watches around. Shop 30 to 60% off Movement's variety of designs, colorways, and functionalities. From the thinnest automatic dress watch under $500 to waterproof guarantee adventure-ready sport watches to rare ceramics, Movement's got options for everyone on your list. Whether you're gifting for family, friends, or yourself, be the good gifter this year with Movement's huge site-wide holiday sales and enjoy the usual fast and free shipping. Shop 30 to 60% off now at movement.com. That's MVMT.com.
Early holiday savings have arrived at Tanger Outlets. Discover the best gifts from your favorite brands, perfect for everyone on your list. And stack your savings with up to 70% off, plus an extra 15 to 25% off only during Tanger Style. Save at Polo Ralph Lauren, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, Skechers, J. Crew Factory, and more. Hurry in. These early holiday deals last through November 24th. Tanger Outlets. More savings, more cheer.
The sun's shining, birds are singing, and all feels right in the world.
Until the season changes, and suddenly you lose your motivation to get out of bed. In fact, 1 in 5 people experience some form of depression, no matter the season or time of year.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all, because we want you to live your best life and be your best you all year round.
Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter. We have a Patreon. Please support us on Patreon. If you want ad-free episodes, bonus content, we forgot to mention it before.
Oh, is this a divisive five, Mark?
No, but last time it was, and this time
we missed it.
We don't like to...
So we'll squeeze it in.
We'll squeeze it in. Patreon.com/swag.
We only talk about this thing once every 5 episodes.
Yep. We appreciate your support a great deal.
Mark already said bonus stuff, but it is a ton of bonus stuff. And not only do we bonus stuff every week, you have the entire backlog of stuff we've done. Crowdfunding.
Hundreds and hundreds
Mark
of episodes.
Mark does a whole show called Bloat. There's a Sizzler. There's a whole talk on Spirit Island. All sorts of stuff.
And most importantly, the warm glow of supporting independent media.
And then for the listeners that are Patreons only, you are going to be getting advanced links to videos before we put them up on YouTube so you can give us feedback immediately and tell us what we need to fix, which will be coming up this week.
We will put you to work, yeah. So, on the topic of Reiner Knizia, one of Reiner Knizia's tiling games is Ingenious that was originally published as Einfach Genial. And there's going to be a 3D version where you can stack tiles up.
I saw that. It looked very interesting.
Yeah, Ingenious is one of those tiling games that I'm perfectly happy to play if it's in front of me, but it's a little too abstract, a little too puzzly for my tastes. And I'm very curious to see what adding the third dimension is going to do. So now when you lay a tile, this gives you new opportunities to bust into new colors that you wouldn't necessarily be into. It means that the board will remain more open for longer. Which could be good, could be bad, but it'll definitely be an interesting variation. And so I'm somewhat curious about Einfach Genial 3D.
And for me, same sort of thing, a reprint of a game. This is Clans of Caledonia Industria. So Clans of Caledonia is putting out a expansion for their game that was out so many years ago.
This expansion has been teased for a very, very long time.
This is on crowdfunding right now. It adds a whole new board of trains. You're going to be moving trains along a track, delivering goods to Scottish villages. Adds all sorts of new tiles and stuff to the base game. And now, and this is very reasonable. I looked at the prices, and you get such a discount off of the MSRP of the regular game. So if you don't have Clans, if you've traded away and want this new stuff, they've made it very cheap. I don't want to say cheap.
Cheap is pejorative. Very affordable.
Affordable to get back into Clans of Caledonia.
Yeah, I've always preferred Clans of Caledonia to Terra Mystica. It's basically Terra Mystica with a bit of a market element attached to it, and it's a little more dynamic than Terra Mystica because you start slaughtering animals to satisfy missions, and so that space is now open, and it leaves new opportunity for interaction independent of the market manipulation. I'm very curious to see what's going to happen.
All sorts of new maps, double-sided maps, all sorts of different ways to... Because that was another big part of Clans of Caledonia as well, was much like Terra Mystica, was, you know, blocking off parts of the map.
Absolutely.
Interested to see what they do.
Walker.
Yes. That's me.
I have you on record a few weeks ago.
Lies.
Talking about how you had gotten out of Star Trek Ascendancy, but there was one way that they might try to sucker you back in, and that's because they were teasing a new race.
I was outmarked.
For Star Trek Ascendancy.
They draw me back.
And it is possible that if the new race were the Gorn, you might... It is the Gorn, Walker. The new race is the Gorn. Yeah. Are you going to be getting a styrofoam boulder to celebrate?
I don't know. I don't know what to do now.
Are you going to wear get some sort of terrible rubber lizard mask?
And I don't even know anyone.
LARP some Gorn?
I don't even know anyone locally that has Star Trek Ascendancy.
I had a copy. I gave it to a patron, yeah.
I know people locally that enjoy Star Trek Ascendancy.
Uh-huh.
I don't know anyone that actually has it. And I don't know if I'm willing to... It's expensive.
It is expensive. You should have been doing the work. You should have been planting the seeds a while ago and just needling them gradually until... Yeah. Gorn.
And it's another game. It is a huge 4X-y,
4-plus-hour
game.
It is a long-time commitment.
But
yes.
I do love the Gorn, and it is too bad that I don't think I'll ever
Who
be
doesn't
able
love the Gorn? I mean, come on. So that is the news, and why it doesn't matter, we now move on to opening the box downers. So, Walker, what makes you sad?
So this was...
We don't do this often. We have a reputation for being overly negative. That's because we're one of the only media outlets that's willing to say that games aren't good. But let's be negative, Walker. Let us dwell in our negativity.
So this idea came to me when I opened up the DEI box, Mark.
Uh-huh.
And on the very top of this DEI box, I saw two very large sheets, not even like standard sized, extra large sites of double-sided stickers. And I thought, what on earth are these for? And then I realized, oh, I'm going to have to build every single board tile for this game, which some of them have 3 levels, and there are,
I have to say,
15 of them.
You did a great job. After the manufacturing is all done, it does the 3D effect of the boards of DEI are very good. I do have to say, though, that it is very cruel of Ludus Magnus Studio to make you go through all this. Don't they know that you recently had a stroke?
I know. Evil is what they are.
I was going to say callous, but sure.
Yes, and you have to line them all up. Anyway, it was a thing.
Well, especially since one could be forgiven for looking at the product, and given the profusion of double-layer boards, I could easily imagine that people might acquire DEI thinking that the boards came like that.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting that it's some sort of that many people are going to be like, oh, well, I'm unable. Some people might have a disability preventing them from being able to manufacture it properly. It's just, you know, again, it'd be a downer. It's like, oh, I was looking forward to seeing these cool... Oh, I have to build all the boards.
And they have to be done in a specific, exact way.
Yeah.
Right? Because some scenarios that you pick, the resources have to go in a certain area. So even like the orientation has to be exact. Anyway.
There are spares, though, in the sticker sheet, right? So
yes. When I finished, there was some left over. Thankfully, because sometimes when you peel off those double things, it leaves the adhesive there.
That is true.
And that happened several times.
Well, so I was just thinking there would be the opportunity to fix mistakes if you misapply one. Because you don't care if there's visible damage on something that's going to be covered.
Yes.
Just if you make a terrible, terrible mistake, you're kind of out of luck. But
yeah.
That's that. Yeah. Yeah, I remember... It is difficult for me to have anything but positive associations with SEAL Team Flicks, the only game that matters. But when I understood that I was going to have to assemble the boards, but there's something about those long punch boards in large quantity and thinking about all the assembly that it is a way to dampen your enthusiasm, that is for sure.
It is very daunting.
Absolutely. So can we talk about inserts? I've got a whole bunch of complaints about inserts.
All right, let's do inserts. I did initially think of something with inserts, but it was mostly when they're paper, you know, done with either cardboard or paper, and then obviously the weight of, you know, the giant stack of punch boards like we just talked was too much, and you open the box and the paper inserts are like flattened and or just destroyed.
Yeah, I don't mind that too much. It is a bit sad looking, though. You're right. I kind of relish that because it is the further encouragement to just get rid of the thing
to
in the first place.
It, like, which usually
and
happens anyway.
I've turned a bit of a corner. I toss far more inserts than I used to, but there's one kind of insert that I find very, very difficult to dispense with, and that is a category of inserts that I would classify as almost there inserts. These are the worst inserts imaginable, and so consequently, every time I see them, my heart sinks. So the modern art insert of the new CMON version, I think, qualifies because it's got labeled trays for all the currency bits, but they don't quite fit properly in terms of the denominations. Some of them, there's too many. Some of them, there's too few. But there's a little well for the little gavel, so I can't get rid of the insert.
The worst part of the dogs of war.
That's the worst one. That's
inserts that make you stack money or resources.
Yes.
Like, they don't just give you a well, dump them in there. No. You need to stack them all.
So there are these circular tokens for victory conditions, and there are these circular coins. And it is not uncommon for an insert to be molded such that you can put the entire stack on its side in the insert. But then you have to painstakingly put them in. Well, you could try to put them all in at once, but that's just asking for trouble. They'll just go flying. I really need to get rid of the insert for Dogs of War, but the problem is that it's almost there. It's got these lovely little slots for the little hats.
It's almost there. Next thing I hate, Mark, is you open the box. Sometimes it's taped to the outside of the box. Sometimes it's inside the shrink wrap, but a lot of the times it's just on the very top of the box. It's, here's your errata for your brand new game.
Well, yeah.
And that's a plus and a minus.
It is.
It's great that it's there, but I just bought this brand new game. I don't want there to be problems with it already. I want it to be a brand new game.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It is strange. I find the presence of the physical errata in the published version. Again, you open the box and it's a bit of a downer. And it is completely irrational of me to kind of sort of almost prefer to have to go online to find the answer. I don't know. It's weird. This is one of those perverse things. What about catalogs, Walker? How do you feel about catalogs?
I had that in the back of my head. I hate them only because, and I don't want to say just because it's just me, but I really feel that no one looks at these catalogs. And it's just a waste of paper.
Rio Grande Games is the worst offender because they have this catalog that is so many years out of date and they keep putting it in. Everything. I remember, there's only been slight variation on this catalog over the course of the past 20 years. I've been seeing this catalog for 20 years, Walker. More than 20, more like 25, honestly.
Fantasy Flight was really bad for it as well.
Oh, yeah. Because, look, even back 10, 15 years ago, the pace of releases was sufficiently fast that they were always out of date when the catalog would come in there. Oh, geez.
And you can get all this stuff online. You don't need it in the box.
Well, I'm sure at some point, someone either for good or bad reasons decided that it was worth their time, effort, and money to put these catalogs in here for marketing purposes. I don't understand what kind of marketing works and what kind of marketing doesn't work.
Yeah.
I'm certainly not going to be one of those people that's like, marketing doesn't work on me. No, marketing works on everybody. Just a lot of it fails. There's the old joke in advertising that's 50 cents out of every dollar spent in advertising is wasted. Just nobody knows which 50 cents. And I think that's very much true of marketing. But yes, I open up the box and I see like a couple of little extra flyers and it's like, ugh.
What would be great marketing would be expansions for the game that you just bought. That I would be okay with. Like you open it up and said, here's everything else that is available for the game that you just bought.
Sure.
I think that would be fine.
Yeah, fair enough.
Next thing up, it would be sprues, Mark. Plastic sprues. And it doesn't happen very much anymore. But it did,
yeah,
it did happen. It did happen in Space Hulk. It did happen in Blood Bowl. A lot of
anything
the
by Games Workshop, obviously.
But it also happened in, what was it, Shadows Over Brimstone?
Yeah.
It happened there, and I could not believe it.
Whenever you get a game from a miniatures game company, you have to expect the sprue. But yeah, it's tough, especially since it's weird. If you show me a picture of a painted miniature, unless it has a very, very large amount of text next to it that says miniatures come pre-painted, I'm going to assume that I have to assemble it myself because I assume what happens is that somebody assembled this and painted it themselves. And yeah, it'll have the teeny little vision that's, you know, models supplied unpainted. But if you show me a picture of an unpainted model, I'm going to assume it comes assembled. Again, maybe this is me being perverse. So yes, rarely, but on occasion, I believe over the course of my hobbyist career, maybe only once or twice, I've opened a box and seen sprues where I did not expect sprues.
And I loved how
Warhammer Underworlds?
Underworlds. I love how Underworlds did it. You did have to clip them off the sprues, but after that, they all push together. Yeah,
yeah. The Push-Fit Games Workshop models are really interesting. I'm remembering that Aliens, Another Glorious Day in the Core, a whole bunch of people didn't get the memo that you had to cut and assemble those miniatures.
Yeah, and it's not so bad for people. Well, I don't say people. People like me, I have all the stuff here from my old hobby to do that. I have the cutters, I have the glue, I have the knowledge and the experience of how to do it. But imagine if you're like a first-time board gamer and I watched this movie, I'm going to buy this game, and you open it up and it's like, well, now what?
Yep.
Brutal.
Rule books, Walker.
I have that. It's my next one. I'm just going to say non-standard rule books, Mark.
Yes. Like trying to reinvent the wheel.
Like, I open it up and you give me a map fold rule book. I have several addresses, Mark. I'm going to find these people.
Well, even if it's a single sheet that's folded. So, like, don't llama dice. You object to that for even small box games?
No, small box games is fine.
Yeah, larger box games. I have too many rules documents. Too few rules documents.
Well, I knew you'd have too few. I have, like, rule books that are just too big. It's like, what are the dimensions of the box? We're going to make the rule book that big.
Yeah, a lot of people really hate that. I don't mind too so, much. So you know, like, the standard square size box.
So you're sitting there and you're trying to keep it flat and it's flopping around in your hand. And then you try to turn the page and you're trying to manipulate this, you know.
I hear you.
40 by 40 rule book.
It doesn't bother as much as other people, but I definitely understand it. You know, and by too few rule books, I mean, or too few rules documents, I mean, no, a game where I expect references are going to be necessary and they don't have any. And so I have to go hunting for things. This is related to one of your pet peeves of rule books. I don't know if this is something that bothers you right when unboxing it for the first time, and that is the back of the rule book being a blank image.
It is, but it's not something you like. I notice immediately on opening. So I didn't want to include it.
Sure.
But the one thing I do have tacked on rule books is when you open it up and there's 8 rule books.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to include every single language in the box.
If it's other languages, I don't mind.
I do, because every other company has language-dependent packaging. It's like this, we're going to print these ones for this country. We're going to print these ones for this country. That way, we're not wasting all of this paper.
Walker, I respect the fact that you find other languages frightening and disorienting.
I don't at all.
I don't know. I don't mind having
all the other companies seem to be able to do it just fine.
Well, Jimmy's mom lets him play video games. That doesn't get to me. Have you ever received a game secondhand that was unsorted in its entirety? That it was just basically...
Is it poured into the box?
Yeah, just everything poured into the box. I've had that.
Not that I can remember.
Most trade partners are very conscientious. And indeed, some of the times when I've opened up a box and it's an undifferentiated swill, basically a puddle, a pool of here's a couple cards from 3 different decks and here's various other tokens... Often that's just because a bag failed or because they relied too much on the insert, which they really shouldn't QV almost their inserts. But I have a non-trivial number of times after a trade opened up the box and it's just everything.
I'd love it.
It is absolutely everything is just completely mixed in. Oh, my goodness.
I would love it. I've always had, you know, I have that thing. It's like, well, what if someone, like, dumped all of my board games into a giant pile? And I'm like, can I pay someone to do that?
Yeah, yeah.
And I just get to sit there and I get to reorganize. It would be something I would love. I'm not just that kind of sick person.
Now, this doesn't tend to happen in the context of retail or crowdfunding. Honestly, I've only ever had, I think, a couple of times where board games have been shipped to me in new condition and there was a failure of packaging such that there was any damage, maybe only once or twice. But this is related to another issue, which is when there's a board game full of expansions, you got the deluxe all-in version, whatever, it comes in the one big box, and there's no guide to put it all away. I see all the game trays or whatever, all the different boxes, and I look at it, I'm never going to remember how to put this all back. I'm never going to be able to get it back in the proper order. I'm going to have to look online. I'm going to have to desperately hope that some kind soul on BoardGameGeek took a picture of everything with all the components where they belong, and then also has some sort of guide to put it back in, because otherwise I'm never going to figure it out.
One thing I have here is, like, sometimes when just the cardboard sprues, right? Sometimes they list on the sprue, you know, what it is, or it's with all the other things. So when you open up the box, and sometimes a lot of things have already fallen out of the sprues,
yep.
That sometimes kind of bugs me. And then this is another one that's same with the DI. I already told you about this. You didn't seem it was a big problem, but I hate. And it doubled down with DI because they have these two-layered boards. They have these very deluxe boards, but then they have these these other boards that you also use in every game that stay on the table the whole time.
It's just cardstock.
Just flimsy card. And I don't know, for whatever reason, that just bugs me.
I can respect that. I don't mind. Well, I might. Well, tell you what, this is one of those instances where I think on initial unboxing, I'd get a bit of a downer, right? I'd see that there's really high quality components and then some other stuff. But once I understand what the various things are for, that kind of decision doesn't bother me, because if it's just there to serve as a display, upgrading it to thick cardboard doesn't do anything for me. And so I'm saving weight, I'm saving materials, I'm saving cost. And thicker cardboard is easier to scuff in transportation in the context of just boxing and reboxing and bringing it places. So if it's just a display of cards, I will later come to appreciate that it's just cardstock. One thing, though, in initial component choices that does bother me on initial unboxing is that if the color choices are bad, if the color matching choices are bad, it's like, okay, well, this is the kind of blue faction. This is the faction that's a different shade of blue. Here's the teal faction. I'm like, come on. Could you at least make them sufficiently distinct? I really also have a bias, for what it's worth, of factions that correspond neatly to a noun. Through the Desert gets a pass because it needed 10 different colors. And pastel camels are delightful. Whatever. Everybody else, don't try to reinvent colors. I don't want to look at a color and struggle for a noun to apply to it. That's just a challenge I don't have to deal with. Make them distinct. Make them easily differentiable. Try to make them colorblind friendly, of course. And make sure that I know what to call them. Don't try to be like, oh, well, this is, we're going to have white, we're going to have natural, we're going to have, like, Gnar really falls victim of that. There's kind of pinkish, but not really. There's white, there's natural color, which isn't really brown, and then there's a dark, ugh.
Yeah, it's bad.
Super disappointing.
Last thing for me would be the empty box. Like, you open up the box.
Yeah.
Standard, like, Ticket to Ride.
Yep.
And the board fits in the top. And there's probably maybe one or two punch boards, like cardboard punch boards.
I see.
And then you lift those out, and then there's like one little bag of components. And then the rest of the box is completely empty, and you're just like, why? Because you didn't want to put another fold in your board game, in the main board? Like, come on.
We've really been spoiled over the course of the past few years. Like, Devir is obviously leading the way,
yes. But
the push for smaller board game boxes has really been paying dividends. And I really think that we're kind of correcting the excesses of before.
Yeah, it's definitely not as bad as it used to be,
for sure. Boxes were too big. Inserts were generic. And so, yeah, they were molded plastic, but they weren't designed for the game in question, so you didn't know where to put anything. Yeah, absolutely. Wasted space, also a huge downer.
Especially when it comes to expansions, right? Biggest.
Yes.
Because they're just going to usually go in the, well, at least for us, lots of people don't do it the way we do, but
right. Most
of the time they're just going to be thrown into the main box anyway, so I wish it was, like I've always said, I wish they'd just come in a sealed bag.
Sure.
Right? And you could have two options. Like, when you buy it, it's like we have the box version and we also have just this bagged version.
Yeah, multiple SKUs are hard, but I respect that. Yeah. In an ideal world, I would want things to work that way as well. Let us move on from this negativity, Walker.
Yes.
Let us close on a positive note. And that positive note is, thank you, listeners, for joining us.
We'll see you next time.
Take care of yourself, take care of your hobby, and please, thank your Rules Explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
This is the story of the one who, as a maintenance specialist for a historic high-rise, knows that vintage charm historically needs constant attention. Which is why, when it's time to upgrade turn-of-the-century mechanicals, they turn to Grainger. With easy access to a million-plus products and the scale to deliver when and where you need them, the right tools and supplies are never far away. So the one can keep that vintage building running like new. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The changing of seasons can affect how you feel. 1 in 5 people experience some form of depression, no matter the time of year.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.